I remember I had two patients, and Fred probably went through this too, that had oxygen levels in the 80s for 5 days straight and with fevers of 103. Since the adaptation of using ivermectin, I've had no cases like that. Everyone's oxygen within 24 to 48 hours normalizes.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. I'm Betsy Ashton. I'm your host, and I'm the creative director of the FLCCC Alliance. And I like to hang out with the doctors who treat patients because they know what's going on. They're holding the hands. They know what has happened. They see what this disease has done. And in the case of the doctors that I'm working with, they also are experts at reading and interpreting studies, and they know the wheat from the chaff. They're good people. And let me tell you, we've got three of the best here tonight who have been treating the patients, treating as outpatients and in the hospitals. And we are here once a week, just letting you know, we're here for 45 minutes to an hour. And our whole purpose is to tell you about treatments and prevention of COVID-19, stuff that really works. Now, in just a moment, you're going to hear from our Dr. Eric Osgood, who has treated very sick patients in the hospital and some less so, and Drs. Keith Berkowitz and Fred Wagshall, who have large outpatient practices in New York City and in Dayton, Ohio, and they have successfully kept hundreds of patients out of hospitals during the entire stretch of this pandemic. They're going to tell you how they've done it, and then they're all going to take your questions about COVID, as many as we have time for. But first, I've just got to give you a little bit of business here. The disclaimer, you have to understand that we are not giving you personal medical information. We have no clue what's going on inside your body. We don't know what other drugs you take, what diseases you've ever been, treated for. So what you do is take the information that we will be sharing tonight and take it back to your own personal physician so that you can do what is best for you. And the other important thing I have to tell you is who we really are. The FLCCC Alliance, Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We are offering education and information. We are not selling drugs. We are not manufacturing them. We don't make a cent off of ivermectin or anything else, any of the vitamins or stuff that's in any of the protocols that our medical team has put together. This is all about, we just came together to try to save lives in a pandemic. That's it. And that's what we're trying to do, which means, of course, that we live off donations. And God bless those of you who have been so kind to send us donations that have helped keep this outreach going to try to educate the world on what the media is not covering and what a big, powerful force is trying to keep from telling you about. So thank you for all of you who are helping us. You are absolutely great. And now I want you to hear from three really fabulous doctors. Are you guys ready? Dr. Osgood, can you take it away? Okay, yeah, go ahead.
You guys are hearing me okay?
Yes, we can.
All right, great to be back. Thank you so much for having me host again the webinar. And I couldn't be more pleased to have a couple of great doctors on the panel with me today who have been doing such important work in the outpatient setting, which I've gotten a little bit of a taste of. I've dabbled in some outpatient telemedicine. And just to open up, and then I'm really going to let these two doctors take it away because they have so much more insight and knowledge into this field than I do, which is outpatient medicine, where I'm primarily working in the hospital. But my hat's off to the outpatient doctors who have taken care of patients during the pandemic, because really with an unprecedentedly small amount of guidance from public health agencies, or guidance literally to do nothing, really de-emphasis in terms of adequate protective equipment, de-emphasis in terms of, hospitals, healthcare, heroes, work care, everything was really dedicated, hospitals, PPE recognition, where if you're sitting in the office, you have the pre-symptomatic and early symptomatic people, probably with the highest viral loads, most amount of contagiousness. So really, doctors in the office were putting themselves at a tremendous amount of risk. And I want to just take this moment for whoever's listening to make sure we give a big thanks and moment of appreciation to the work that they're doing, which I just feel like has not been sufficiently appreciated by the public and by public health agencies and media during the pandemic. And really the sort of demonization of doctors who are trying to do what they can to help their patients. And so my hat's off to Dr. Wachtel and Dr. Berkowitz, who I'm so happy to have on the panel with me. And we're going to hear from you guys about what you've been doing during the pandemic with your patients, what your experiences have been, and how patients have responded, what you've seen. We've talked about data. I'm the big data nerd. I love talking about it. Some of the Twitter people who follow me on Twitter have seen some of the videos I've talked about data. Let's hear some actual, tangible, non-armchair, in the field, real world doctors and what they're doing. And so with that, I see Keith, you're here on the screen. Do you have any opening comments, anything you want to say to the
sure.
audience?
I also want to thank the nurses and the support staff because they actually protect the doctors. And without
yes.
them, we would never survive.
That's right.
So Fred would, I'm sure, see the same thing.
Absolutely.
So I could start with the early part of the disease. So it was really interesting. In February of 2020, we started seeing flu-like cases, and I didn't really know what they were. I thought it was influenza. You know, we really didn't check. And actually, what's interesting enough, they turned out to be COVID. So my early treatment, what I had available is actually I was using intravenous vitamin C. So Dr. Merrick would be happy. And what was interesting, people recovered within 24 hours from that. Their lab work got better within a week. And it was really, we didn't realize 2 months later when I tested their antibodies that these were actually my first round of COVID patients that I was seeing. And it was interesting that early treatment, and that's when I actually started looking at, you know, vitamin C, and then we eventually led to ivermectin months later.
And how did you come to start using ivermectin? What was the threshold of evidence that you saw that made you decide, you know what, I need to start offering this to my patients?
So it was interesting. We had read studies, you know, looking at from Australia that showed some in vitro studies. But interesting enough, I actually met an infectious disease doctor that had started in April of 2020 in New Jersey using ivermectin. And that was pretty unheard of. And he had tremendous results treating pretty immediately. And that's where I first learned about it. And then later, seeing the studies through Dr. Merrick and Dr. Curry and the FLCC, that's when I learned even more of that.
Okay. And what has been the timeline? Because, you know, I don't do as much outpatient, but really for me, it was people who were coming to me asking for help at the beginning. I'm starting to see a few more patients now. But the timeline I'm seeing is that usually within a matter of about 6, 8, maybe 10 hours after the second dose, back when I was doing the 0.2, milligrams per kilogram. Now I'm doing 0.4. But usually within about 8, 10 hours after that second dose, patients would report really dramatic improvements. Like people have described to me, like they just felt like the disease was leaving them. Their chest cleared up, their aches and their fevers kind of abated. And the timing I found interesting was always very similar. Would you say that your results have been similar to that, or has it been more?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would let Fred answer that. I've treated probably 100 patients. Fred's probably what, 500 now?
All right, bring Fred in. Yeah, Fred, I'd love to hear from you.
We're up to over 600 patients on ivermectin. Let me preface all this by saying that most of the public will not know that Keith and I have been in this from the beginning as founding members. And Keith and I are really the only outpatient physicians. I've done 25 years of running 5 intensive cares at Kettering Medical Center here in Dayton. But in the past 10 years, I've been in practice 35 years. We've done only outpatient therapy. And I will have 3 to 4 patients probably every day say, do you remember when I was sick back in November of 2019? And I'll say to them, yeah, I do remember. Who took care of you? And they go, well, you did. Well, how did we manage people? Not even thinking of COVID, not even having any idea, but being a pulmonologist and a critical care guy, we would manage these people as outpatients on combinations of steroids and antibiotics. And it wasn't until February when everything shut down that we were able to put a name on this. And between March and June of 2000, the FLCCC, under the tutelage and great appreciation of Dr. Paul Marek and Pierre Corey, we forced Oxford to do a recovery trial for steroids, and that changed the NIH and the WHO. And suddenly steroids were approved. My mentor at Yale was Dr. Umberto Maduri, and he pioneered non-invasive ventilation, but also steroids. And historically, in our specialty, we've always used plenty of steroids. So come June into July, suddenly it was kosher to use steroids on COVID pneumonia, realizing that the obliterative bronchitis and pneumonias are seen on CAT scans was inflammation and microclots. It wasn't viral pneumonia per se. Well, if we now fast forward another 3 months from June to September, Paul Marek creates a YouTube video for his students at East Virginia Medical School based on the signal he picks up about ivermectin. And in his YouTube video, he explains much of the mechanisms of how ivermectin works with its binding to the spike protein and blocking the reproduction of the virus and different mechanisms. And from that point, Dr. Marek showed us data from Hector Caraballo in Argentina, where a group of 800 doctors and nurses, when left on ivermectin weekly, had 100% protection. It was at that point, on a Zoom conference for all of us, we realized we had an oral protective medicine. And from that point on, my practice started using ivermectin in addition to steroids and antibiotics and all the other tools that your typical pulmonologist would use. And when we really ramped up the use of ivermectin, say November, December, now through June, we've had over 600 patients by themselves on ivermectin in different stages of the disease, some just preventatively, prophylactically, another percentage of them in acute disease where we couldn't bring them in the office for safety reasons, but over telemedicine, we could certainly start them on combinations of ivermectin and vitamins and zinc and everything. If they had respiratory complaints, which many of our people did, we put them on steroids. And only months later, when the word came out that irregardless of severity of illness at the very beginning of COVID, you could months later have multi-systemic complaints of what appeared to be low-grade inflammation. And we realized that the treatment of this was some combination of ivermectin and steroids. And we sort of learned that by trial and error. And mechanistically, how many of us like to think of, well, how or why should ivermectin work as a preventative? How should it work as an acute early treatment, even in late treatment? But how should it even work in long haulers? Eric, you and I think we sort of learned this from Dr. Bean when he started to explain on his diagrams how the body's immune systems and some of the reactive blood cells, the macrophages, gobble up these dead viral particles. And they hold on to them until the cell life of the macrophage itself dies. And what people don't understand is, in COVID, at day 14, the virus dies and breaks into dead viral particles. And as these disseminate through the body, that's what triggers this acute inflammation, so-called cytokine storm, in all different organs. Dr. Bean diagrammed it perfectly, that the macrophages gobble up all these dead viral particles that are inducing inflammation, and they hold them isolated from blood and the rest of the body. But as they go through their life cycles, the macrophages die and they release these dead viral particles that seem to trigger low-grade inflammation. And because all of the macrophages die at all different rates, the body seems to be bombarded with a very low-grade inflammatory state that then gets translated into systemic symptoms, everything from brain fog to potentially respiratory stuff to neurologic complaints. And I think that's sort of maybe where we're at, because clearly the long haulers have benefited from ivermectin, and most of them will say, "Doc, it wasn't until I was on ivermectin 3 to 5 days, a veil lifted. Suddenly, I realized I wasn't going to die. Suddenly, for the first time, my migraines went away. My back pain went away. I wasn't short of breath anymore. I could feel my feet." So clearly, ivermectin, via the anti-inflammatory properties that it has late, unrelated to the COVID virus itself, because that spike protein is long gone, has very certain properties that have been just unbelievable. And
you know what's interesting about that is I've actually had people I've treated with ivermectin when they were acutely ill and then had to retreat 1 or 2 months later, which was interesting. They had, when they started exerting themselves again, some of those symptoms actually came back up. And clearly the virus was no longer there 2 months later. But they had this inflammatory process that was still going on. They had shortness of breath again. A cough came back. And actually, they required retreatment. And after that second retreatment, the symptoms really abated.
It's kind of...
I just want to jump in. You mentioned Dr. Bean, and I do have to say, I have been given the distinct honor of getting a Bean nickname for my...
Oh,
daughter.
I have one.
I'm very jealous of Dr. Bean's artistic abilities because I'm a terrible artist. So I am Jelly Bean.
Isn't that a rapper? So
I'm Dr. Fred Bean. He and I have like the same conversation. But also, Keith, you're right. We've had to retreat many of these people, and it's really not clear what the source of their ongoing inflammation is. That's why when I think mechanistically that we've sequestered some of these dead viral particles within our immune system cells, and slowly they're being released to create this type of low-grade inflammatory effect.
I don't know if you noticed, but what I've seen, which is strange, when I measure inflammatory markers, they're negative. So months later, they don't have any other lab signs of the virus or some kind of inflammatory process, but they just feel ill. And that's what's interesting. So we're not really seeing a necessary correlation from an inflammatory standpoint, more from a symptom standpoint, which I think confuses us tremendously.
I think that's why Bruce Patterson's work has been so important, and Ram Yogendra, and what they're doing up there in Cambridge is pretty phenomenal, molecular precision medicine. And they've basically shown what we're talking about, that we kind of had as far as this hunch, that exactly they've actually been able to isolate this COVID protein from inside of macrophages and people that have recovered months and months later. And they're actually working on this targeted based therapy to try to use anything from viral entry the entry of viral particles to, immunomodulatory therapy. And they've been having a lot of success with this sort of targeted precision medicine. And I've been working with them a little bit more closely, and some upcoming exciting things that I'll be announcing in terms of me getting to work with them a little bit more closely. But I want to hear more from you guys. When your patients, do you have any hunch that any of these patients you're treating, their improvement might've just been from the natural history of the disease, or do you feel very confident that this was the result of your intervention?
So I can tell you, March, April, May, I didn't sleep. So I was managing patients at home. We were afraid of the hospital because of the intubation issues, and the patients wouldn't go anyway to the hospital. So we were, it took days for their oxygen to recover. I remember I had two patients, and Fred probably went through this too, that had oxygen levels in the 80s for 5 days straight and with fevers of 103. Since the adaptation of using ivermectin, I've had no cases like that. Everyone's oxygen within 24 to 48 hours normalizes. I have not seen fevers last really longer than 24 hours. And that's been a big difference. My sleep has been so much better, let me tell you. But and no even thought of hospitalization, where and early on, you know, these patients, and a lot of them were teetering on being hospitalized or actually probably in the hospital and then end up being intubated. So I have not seen any of that since the introduction of that into my practice in November and December.
Out of roughly 600 patients, I think I've had one or two who presented to an emergency room. Amazingly enough, in America, still, there's no standard of care for outpatients. Patients get sick, they will go to an emergency room. If they're not sick enough for admission, they're sent home to quarantine. They're not giving in any medicines. And the U.S. has been very effective as far as censorship in press media, mainstream news media, cable news media. They've blacked out this message about ivermectin. And the worst part of it is it almost bridged an entirely different industry called technology. It would be one thing if just the NIH and the CDC and the WHO didn't like ivermectin because it was too cheap, had no side effects and no drug interactions. I can understand. All right. That would be a bad medicine for them. I can understand that they wouldn't like ivermectin because it takes away the emergency use authorization. Couldn't come with vaccines because we have an existing medicine that works. But how does it make a bridge to suddenly censor Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube? I don't understand how they make that connection. And here in America and in Western Europe, there are many, many bright physicians and researchers, and not just Europe, South America, in the African continent, in the Far East. Many of them are American trained. All of the data and studies that Dr. Corey and Dr. Marek, and we all look through, but Dr. Corey's been championing every day. Kudos, because this is real data. For the NIH to state that we don't trust it because it's not done on Americans, nonsense on them. The one study they tried to champion, which was a bad study recently, was sponsored by them and done in Colombia. So it's just so hypocritical.
And people recovered 2 days earlier. So it wasn't that they didn't get better. You know what's interesting about COVID-19 now to me? It's kind of flipped from an acute disease to a chronic disease. Yeah. Like early on, we saw all these high levels of patients in the hospital. Now we're kind of seeing these chronic cases where we're seeing people with chronic symptoms post-disease. And it's really kind of morphed into a second stage. And what's interesting, and I'm seeing a lot of long haulers, is that they're much harder to treat than the acute patients, which I find that I often have to give multiple rounds of ivermectin for them to get better. That, you know, one round doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And I don't know if you measure in your practice, Fred, I measure the spike protein level antibodies. And oftentimes I'll see that pattern with these long haulers. What I'll also see, which is really interesting, I would say 90% of them have low vitamin C levels. Yes. So I also draw serum vitamin C levels, and a fair number have low serum vitamin D levels. And vitamin D is really interesting to me because I always joke the range they say 30 is enough. Maybe if for, I don't know who, but, you know, we look to levels 60 to 70, at least. I don't know what you see to see really an improvement. But that's what I'm finding much more challenging now is really treating post cases, people that supposedly recovered, never went to the hospital, but still don't feel right, still have the brain fog, the headaches, the gastrointestinal symptoms, extreme fatigue, especially with exercise. And those have been really the bigger challenge in my practice.
Yeah, and it's the same here too.
I see them showing up in the ER and they get brought in for observation because they're having chest pain and, you know, palpitations. They get ischemia workup. Nothing really shows anything. They're not having a heart attack. They're not having blockages, but they are having real chest pain, real cardiac and cardiorespiratory symptoms. We can't really do much. Once we rule everything out, it's like, good luck, you know, and now you guys have to take care of them primarily. I'm starting to, you know, dip my toes into that business. I'm starting to see just, in fact, how challenging these patients are. And I feel terrible for these patients because they're being gaslit and told that, I mean, there's nothing wrong with mental health and yoga, things like that, but that's what they're being told to do, right? Go see a psychologist, go to yoga studio. This is just, you know, you have to adjust. You know, you were through something traumatic, you had COVID, you just need to get your mind right. When this is a physiological, pathophysiological disease involving inflammation from viral remnants, and to see patients gaslit this way, it just breaks my heart.
Well, and what's interesting is their oxygen levels are normal. So these people, but what I do find consistent is what I call POTS, which is orthostatic hypotension. A lot of them have blood pressure drops or heart rate rising as they get up from a lying position to standing. That I'm seeing more and more. And what's interesting, once you correct that kind of fluid deficit, then actually the other symptoms are much easier to treat. Until I start treating that fluid deficit, they really don't get better.
Sorry, go ahead, please.
What I was going to say is one of the most amazing situations has occurred. I've had, and Pierre has had dealings with some of the attorneys that have sued and gone to court and had court orders for hospitals to administer ivermectin to what you would, and I would think, to be near terminal patients that have been intubated 21, 28 days. And even in those patients, as they give them ivermectin, I've seen at least 75% of them go home, get extubated, and walk out of the hospital. What drug does that? I've never heard of that. So within the legal community, I'm shocked to see that the American Bar Association itself hasn't looked back at mortality over the past 7 months, let's say like December of 2020, when Dr. Corey and Dr. Marek met with the NIH and told them about ivermectin. We roughly had 6,000 Americans die every day, and the government did nothing. They moved their recommendation from not to recommend to something intermediate. And then come the next 7 months, we're now in June, and we're still not any further down the line. Mortality rates are dropping, all right? But imagine your own government saying it's okay to have 5,000-6,000 die a day and do nothing. I don't get that. And to have primary care networks of doctors associated with Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, big universities, Ohio State, saying, we won't prescribe. We won't even discuss this with you. If you decide you want to take ivermectin, we will release you from our practice. We can no longer see you. American doctors across the country can't be stupid. Everyone reads English. They certainly read medicine. And our message of ivermectin is cogent enough. And the data is there. So how are all these primary care networks controlled to a point where no one will prescribe ivermectin? I don't understand that.
You know, I think we run into problems in medicine a lot of times. We're really good at acute care. And now we're looking at chronic care, and that's really where medicine often falls off. And I think we've kind of created this chronic disease. You know, we started with an acute viral syndrome, and now we are really left with a chronic disease that's around inflammation that can last a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are medical treatments and recommendations that are like, not only are they practiced, they're considered like the right answer. you know, if you're quizzing and grilling your students and, you know, doing rounds that are based on a fraction of the body of evidence that we have for ivermectin and COVID-19, right? I mean, you look at, particularly in the field of infectious diseases, where the majority of what we do and what we're taught is based on, you know, anecdotes and little weak studies. Now, I mean, there we have multiple double-blinded, placebo-controlled, randomized control trials. I promised I wasn't going to talk about data. I'm sorry, my internet is yelling at me. But, you know, really well-designed trials that are actually showing that the virus goes away more quickly when you use ivermectin. And now all of a sudden the goalpost has moved to, well, that's not really a clinical endpoint. That's not really enough. Wait a second. Making the virus go away more quickly doesn't matter in terms of population spread, in terms of reducing the risk of long-haul disease by having less viral material in the body. I mean, to think of a medicine this safe with that kind of tangible benefit and to say, nah, you know, no thanks. Not only no thanks, but we are so opposed to this that we're going to like release you from practice and threaten doctors and have pharmacists overruling doctors. I've just never seen this kind of rabid opposition to such a relatively benign medicine with this kind of body of data.
You have a second effect. All these drugs that are talking about antivirals, now we also have the long-term anti-inflammatory. So you're actually getting two for one with this drug, where as opposed to your typical antivirals, you have clearly an antiviral effect. And if it doesn't work, then you're out of luck, right? If you're too late, if you miss that kind of window for the virus to go away, as Fred was saying before. But with ivermectin, that's the beauty of it. That's why it works so long and so far into the disease, because it also deals with the inflammatory effect.
Yeah.
And very realistically, I know that despite our protocols, and I believe tomorrow, a protocol for the long haulers is going to be coming out also. The dosing and the number of days and the number of milligrams and what to use, none of this is necessarily set in stone. And we're trying to really follow the best guidelines available. But remember, there aren't that many of us treating patients. So that's what we're hampered by. But anecdotally, what we see seems to be working because these people aren't getting worse. They're all slowly getting better. And we all took a Hippocratic oath to treat, not to find reasons not to. So I think someone needs to take then their foot off the neck of American medicine and to sort of wake up. A perfect example of this was Dr. McCullough down in Texas. He's a vice chairman at Baylor. When he got COVID and got sick, he had himself on hydroxychloroquine and da-da-da-da-da-da, and he was getting worse. Put himself on oxygen. Then he put himself on prednisone. And then he put himself on ivermectin. And then suddenly, got over it. So
I'm a survivor too. I had COVID and it worked for me. I mean, definitely, you know, there was no doubt that that was the issue. And I was saying before how people had recurrence. I actually had recurrence of symptoms a couple months later, and I retreated and my symptoms went away completely.
Yeah, I didn't have it, but my younger brother did. I don't think he'd mind me talking about it. And he said, you know, as soon as he started feeling sick, you know, he said his bones felt cold, achy, just really felt terrible. I immediately started treatment. I said, you're not going to wait for your test. I started treatment. He went and got his test. By the time his test came back positive, 100% better. Within, like I said, within about 8 hours of the second dose, just felt the whole thing leaving. But then a few days later, started to feel worse again and had to retreat. And after about another one or two doses, just completely better, got over it. And, you know, for all I know, I could have kept him out of the hospital. I mean, it was a very, very dramatic, very fast effect. This is not really the natural history of COVID-19. I understand it's an N size of three between the three of us, but these are pretty reliable, consistent benefits, at least that I've seen. It sounds like you guys have seen the same.
Yeah.
I think you brought up a really important point is to start treating when symptoms come, not wait for the test to come back. I think that's so critical, where a lot of people make the mistakes in waiting. And the downside of not treating early, there is none. There's a tremendous downside for waiting 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, in the famous words of a South American or Zimbabwe doctor, the worst that can happen is we have a country free of parasitic patients. You know,
exactly.
That's a mosquito repellent too, by the way. So keep the mosquitoes away from you.
But isn't a virus kind of like a parasite? It doesn't help you in the body, right? It's taking advantage of the body. So why not?
We have questions, guys. Yeah. Come on, we have a lot of people who want some answers here. So let me toss a few of these out. We have Bonnie Hardy has asked, since most people are not wearing masks now, what is your recommendation if you're inside a restaurant or a store and you're taking ivermectin? Anybody? Duh. Don't all leap in really quick.
You know, I think we want to be careful. And the public health guidance is that if you have not received the full vaccination, that you should adhere to public health guidelines as far as masks go. That's all you're going to get out of me.
I agree. But it's also a comment that when you look nationally for infection rates, state by state, they're still pretty high, but yet America's opening. And the real threat becomes, are we between people who have been sick, those who have been vaccinated, and those that are on ivermectin, are we in some way approaching herd immunity? Is it safe to be without a mask? And these questions are not answerable. We don't know. And God only knows, public health officials, they're not looking into this either. They can't help.
Well, there's not been great studies, right? That's one thing that really hasn't been studied well. Yeah. And so it's hard to make a good recommendation.
Yeah.
So you basically keep wearing the mask to protect yourself in a situation inside.
Yeah.
And others.
If there was an MIT study that talked about the 6 feet, and they really showed that indoors, 6 feet didn't really offer protection, right? That it's an aerosol disease and it could spread beyond those 6 feet. So it's hard to make, you know, a recommendation in a small setting where it may not be good ventilation and stuff. There still may be a risk.
Okay. We have a question from Nancy Tate. She says, okay, can you doctors explain that if you believe COVID-19 can spread through people with asymptomatic infection? And if so, how does this happen?
Well, I think we have mass confusion about people who have an intact immunity and have had infection and are protected, people that have been vaccinated and are protected, and people who are on ivermectin and protected. We as mammals are air breathers. Viral levels in the air are high still. That's why infection rates across the country are high. We are all going to trap viral particles in our nasopharynx, in the back of our throats. Put a probe up there, you're bound to find virus up there. A positive test, the news media would like to imply that a positive test means you're infected. No. You're a mouth breather, you're trapping virus, you're putting something up there to prove you're trapping virus, but you're not sick with the virus. So we don't have good working definitions of what does a positive test mean and are you infectious to others if you're not infectious to yourself. It's a whole Pandora's box that no one really sat down to think about.
Well, you know, it's interesting about the positive test. Early studies really showed that even at day 6 of symptoms, only 80% tested positive, right? So the question is, by the time you can often test positive, the virus may not be there anymore. And that's what's confusing.
Right. Does the presence of a positive test have really any correlation or ability to say that you have actual replication competent live virus that's culturable that you could transmit to someone else? Kind of hard to say. Just like if I went around randomly culturing everyone's urine and said, aha, you know, E. coli, a Staph saprophyticus case, an E. coli case. No, you're going to find colonization, and that doesn't necessarily mean infection. And it's very hard to tease that out. And so the notion that, you know, if you're not actually sick, there's no way you could transmit that. And there was actually a representative from WHO mid-spring last year who said, yeah, we think asymptomatic spread's really rare. That turned out to be a pretty silly statement, because before you ever spring up a first symptom, you can have pretty high levels of viral replication going on in your upper airway and your nasopharynx. You're breathing that into the air. You're indoors with someone else. Of course, you can give it to somebody else. You might not manifest symptoms for another couple of days after that, and it could be mild.
Well, and also the adolescents, right? A lot of the adolescents who got sick back in March never had symptoms. And the only reason, what's interesting, in my neighborhood, you know why they got tested? Because they were athletes. So they had to have testing to perform. A lot of them tested positive with no symptoms at all.
Wow. Okay. So here we have somebody who says, from D. Yen, he says, regarding the safety profile of ivermectin, the 4 billion doses that were given worldwide was dosed at one dose at 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. So what is the safety profile for 0.4 milligrams per kilogram for 5 days, which is what we're having now, right? For more serious cases, right?
Yeah, there was a big study by a world-renowned French toxicologist who explored this, and he found that unequivocally and incredibly rare were the descriptors for ivermectin side effects. And there have been dose escalation studies that have shown that even at, once you get to like 10 times higher than standard doses, the side effects, the cytotoxicity, the actual damage of your body by ivermectin, very, very rare, very well tolerated. So this 0.4, it might seem, wow, that's double from normal. This is something that's been tested at substantially higher doses than that. And there has not been a signal of significant risk in even in those studies.
And in the hospitals, they often use much higher doses than that to begin with in hospitalized or ventilated patients.
Okay. Yeah. And in Norwegian scabies, it's 0.25 mg per kg, so it's a little higher.
Okay. Another question is, does ivermectin have a role after the vaccine?
Do you want me to answer that? I go answer that.
Go for it.
So it's interesting about the spike protein. So there is some thought that people that have an over robust response after the vaccine with a very high spike protein load sometimes get symptoms very similar to COVID. And I've seen that probably about 30 times now in my practice. And what's interesting, the use of ivermectin in those cases really has shown to actually bring down some of that spike protein level, and actually the symptoms do resolve.
I agree.
Do you think that inhibits the efficacy of the vaccine?
Well, but a lot of times, I'm not sure, because again, after a month, right, you probably have already made an antibody response.
Yeah,
so the immune system has that. So after that period, and the question
is, after that period,
I mean, there was a recent study about where they looked at bone marrow samples, and they found that even people without antibodies still had some memory of the virus and could also respond immunologically. You know, immune system can respond to that virus even without a positive antibody response.
Yeah, and that brings up the interesting question that if you get infected or if you get vaccinated and you don't have antibody levels, are you still protected? And the answer to that, according to the study, Keith, and you're right, the answer is physiologically, your T cells and other parts of the immune system remember what the virus looks like and can always make antibodies. So the amount of disinformation out there from the NIH and the WHO and the CDC about having to look for antibody levels to be a correlate to whether your immunity is good is nonsense.
And what's also interesting on that same issue, I've had several people who were treated with ivermectin, and then we went to do antibody testing, and they're negative. They didn't have spike protein levels that were high enough to come up on the test. So it's interesting. So is the ivermectin therefore lowering that spike protein response? And actually, is that a good thing at the end of the day? And that's what we're not sure. I think you referenced the other study where they looked at mice and they found that the spike protein in absence of the virus can still cause cellular damage.
Yeah. You know, one thing I want to say is I think one of the large reasons that public health bodies have been so antithetical to ivermectin, especially as a pre-exposure prophylaxis, is that people who are maybe on the fence about getting the vaccine are a little hesitant. It's going to maybe further dissuade them, and maybe they don't want to promote people taking, you know. What I would say is I would be willing to bet that if you polled people and said, if people who were kind of on the fence and maybe worried about the side effects of the vaccines, you know, and you asked these people if there were a treatment that you knew you could take if you got really sick from the vaccine that would make you feel better, would you be more likely to get the vaccine? I'd be willing to bet most of the people would answer yes, and you might actually be able to get more people vaccinated if you promoted the fact that there were a treatment that would alleviate symptoms and reduce chances of harm. So I don't really buy into the notion that this is going to somehow dissuade or disrupt the vaccine campaigns.
Yeah, no.
And also we have precedent for this, right? Influenza, where we have a vaccine and a drug, right? This is not new.
Yeah. Right.
I'm sorry, Fred.
No, I'm asked this every day. People say, gee, I'm really hesitant about the vaccine. So part of being a physician in America is to try to teach your patients a little bit of history about the vaccine. It's not 8 to 10 months old. The vaccines come out of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency of the U.S. military. They have been making these types of vaccines since 2002. DARPA is sort of like the sixth branch of the military. It's secretive. It's very well funded. It has its own private internet, but it's responsible for computer systems, weapon systems, telecommunication, biologics. It war game plays. It pandemic plays. They've been making this vaccine vehicle since 2002, and when they inserted and cleaved the RNA from this COVID virus and put it into this vaccine, 4 months later, they handed it off to Pfizer and to Moderna and told them, make this and vaccinate everyone, because they knew it worked. What they don't know, because they've never had to use it, is what are the long-term effects of this? I mean, they've never had to use this vaccine. And the drug makers making it now, they don't have any data on that either. So that's really the question. What's interesting is if you think that you get a maximum protection from the vaccine 14 days after your second shot or 14 days after your first for Johnson & Johnson, you'll maybe get to 95% protection, according to what they're saying publicly. What do we know about ivermectin? If you stay on that weekly, you'll approximate 100% protection. So people ask, can I be on both? Wow.
Why not?
Haven't read any studies on that.
And actually, what's interesting about that comment, my patients traveling to Europe, I am actually giving them ivermectin, even if they've been vaccinated. So again, if you look in the UK now with the Indian variant, cases have risen a lot. You know, I think over 2,500 cases or more now in London. That, you know, would that make a difference? Is our vaccines protective? You probably need both at the end of the day.
Mm. And the need for boosters will be preceded by, you know, people will start to get sick again. And this, you know, this is not like moot, you know, just because there's vaccines. This question still needs to be answered more firmly. And I think the role for this is still important.
Yeah.
Here's a question that Kent Van Arsdale asks. What are the best references to help convince the treatment committee at my hospital to add ivermectin and to help my hospitalist friends feel confident to use it? Think anything will work?
I would parade a bunch of patients that have gotten better and surround the hospital. That's the key at the end of the day. I mean, that's the best reference to me.
Dr. Corey and Dr. Merrick have gone out of their way to put together on our website entire pages with bibliographies and quotes. And we've done interviews, as you know, Betts, with God knows what researchers all over the world.
I've interviewed them, yeah.
And I mean, how much evidence does American medicine need?
I would say, knowing what I know about the way that hospital treatment committees work, if it is not a pretty well-designed randomized controlled trial, they don't want to hear about it, for better or worse. I'm not, you know, and so what I would say would be to compile the randomized controlled trials and present a stack of RCTs and say, look, read through these results, consider risk benefit, point out the safety profile, point out that with everything in medicine, you have to consider, you know, benefit risk, number need to treat, number need to harm. We don't have a huge multi-thousand patient per arm RCT, which is really the best way to know number needed to harm. But we do have global pharmacovigilance data that's shown us that the number needed to harm is beyond enormous. It's just, you know, it's massively high. So you have a lot of wriggle room to work with. Your number needed to treat, you know, is one thing, but you know that the number needed to harm is enormous. So if you see a signal of benefit in something that's that benign, go for it. So you show them the RCTs and you show them the clinical benefits that's been shown in those, I think it's going to be hard to ignore that. But if you can show them all sorts of other compelling data, I know how people in these seats think, they're going to roll their eyes and say, it's not an RCT, I don't want to hear about it.
Well, wasn't penicillin approved without an RCT?
If we go back. Yeah, no,
I'm not, this is like the new penicillin in a lot of ways.
You're preaching to the choir. I'm just telling you. I just want to answer the question of how he can, how you can.
And no one would argue with penicillin today, right?
No, I don't think so.
20 years later.
Right. But so Emily Frankel wants to know, have any of you had any pushback in being allowed to prescribe ivermectin in your practices or hospitals? And if so, how did you overcome it?
That's only you, Eric.
Yeah. You're in private practice. You run your own show, right?
my muscles are too big. No one's going to, I'm just kidding. No, I just, you know, I happen to work in a great hospital that respects its doctors and does not try to interfere in the care of doctors. I have the trust of my, you know, I have institutional trust. Not everybody may agree with me, but I'm, you know, I presented data. You know, we're carefully looking at what we're doing. And I just feel grateful that I work in a setting like that. A lot of my colleagues aren't that lucky.
You know, it's interesting. When I call it to pharmacists about ivermectin, they've already used it on their family, which is so interesting. Almost every pharmacist I talk to is, oh, yeah, we know that drug.
Last question we have, because we're running out of time here. Jake Blatz wants to know, he says, my doctor here in Manitoba, Canada, says when ivermectin is used for scabies, for pinworms, it's given in short doses and you can expect to see 2-3% of the patients develop elevated liver enzymes. What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, that's terrible.
So actually, I can answer that because I've seen the other way around. So what's interesting, in my acute COVID patients, they have elevated liver enzymes and elevated ferritin levels. So actually what I've seen after the ivermectin, those numbers come down. I would say 80% of the people who I've done laboratory studies with acute COVID have elevated liver enzymes from the virus. And those do respond very quickly and come down with ivermectin.
Yes.
Good news. Good news. Well, that's, thank you, Eric and Fred and Keith, you've been fabulous. That's all the time for the questions that we have. And if we didn't get yours tonight, folks, come on back next week. We'll be here at 7 o'clock Eastern, 4 o'clock Pacific, and everything in between. Got a couple of important things to tell you. In the meantime, you know, if you want to keep up with what we're doing, check out flccc.net. That's our website, because we are going to be publishing the iRecover trial. It may be tomorrow or the next day. It's imminent. It's done. It's out. The doctors are reviewing it. It'll come back, but it's imminent. And so you want to check our website to see that. And next week, we're going to be talking about it right here on the, we're going to have the doctors, Pierre Corey is going to be back with Paul Marek. We're going to be talking about why they put everything into the iRecover treatment program for long haulers that they did and at the doses that they did. So that's going to be a really good program. And of course, there's a lot of real scientific data that is on our website. We want you to share that with everyone that you know. One more thing. You remember that we had Dr. Corey on the Dark Horse podcast last week. Well, Steve Kirsch, our friend who has been also championing another drug, fluvoxamine is his favorite, but he funded some studies on that for early treatment. He's going to be on the Dark Horse podcast tomorrow. I think that's 10 a.m. Pacific time. Some of you are going to be interested in seeing that. Another thing I want to tell you is that we're going to keep the chat open for 15 more minutes. So you can keep chatting for 15 more minutes. We know you've got a lot of buddies on here now. We've got a group going. So if you want to plot whatever going, you can do it for 15 more minutes after we sign off, which is basically going to be now. That's it. We've run out of time, but we thank you all for watching. We thank you for your interest. We thank you for everything that you can do to help us. We thank you for your donations and stay well. And thank you, doctors, again. And we'll see you all here next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It was a pleasure. Really enjoyed it, guys. Thanks.